everybody, and welcome to the Ishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. And Chodesh Tov, happy new month. Happy new month. And Chodesh Tov to you, Rabbi Mike Foyer.
Thank you. Chodesh Tov, Ishai. Good to see you.
Great to hear you coming in real nice in the headphones here.
Am I in your left ear or your right?
You're in my left, and we're in stereo, and it's great stuff. And Chodesh Cheshvan, that means we're out of the Tishrei season.
Mar Cheshvan.
Mr. Cheshvan, that's right. That's what I like to call him. Mar.
I never thought of it.
Yeah, that's what I call it. My daughter. Now, Mar Cheshvan means, it could mean bitter.
Depends on who you ask, yeah.
Bitter Cheshvan because there's no holidays. Or it means drop. The word mar also means drop, which means rain. It's rainy season.
That rain, that rain.
But mar in Hebrew is also mister.
Yes.
Okay, so I always tell, I told my daughter Leah, I said, she's like, isn't mar bitter? I said to her, no, it's Mr. Cheshvan. It's like, Mr. Cheshvan, like, come on down. All right, here he is.
And Reb Shlomo yourself to call it Ram
Cheshvan. Ram Cheshvan, that's right, yeah, which means great and holy
lofty,
month.
Lofty, very lofty.
And you know, it's funny, right after the Tishrei season, I say to myself and to my wife and even on the show, like, this is the first day of the rest of your life, right? It's like the day after Isru Chag Sukkot, first day of the rest of your life. Like Parshas Bereishis, the Sunday after,
Mamish.
First day of the rest of your life. But Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan is really...
It's really.
Tishrei is behind. We did it. It was done to us, you know, and it happened. And it was awesome, and it was huge. And even Parshas Bereishis feels like it's still connected.
It is definitely still connected.
To that previous
Who
thing.
Who didn't have the feeling on Shabbat, like, wait, haven't I just done this?
Right, because you did a little bit of Parshas Bereishis.
And perhaps a little bit of feeling like, isn't this a little bit extraneous?
Right. But then you have Noach and Parsha and the month of Cheshvan. For me, I love Cheshvan, big fan of Cheshvan. My daughter was born in Cheshvan. First kid, and also Aliyah Day, which I helped, you know, I wrote the original law, and it passed, and anyway, now it's the 7th of Cheshvan, that happens to be the day that Malk and I came to Eretz Yisrael on Aliyah.
Wow.
So that's a big thing, and it's also the yahrzeit of Rachel Imenu. It also happens to be the yahrzeit of Prime Minister Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin.
Yes.
So a lot of stuff happens in Cheshvan.
And we can finally just have a full month of work.
Right. You're absolutely right. And they came up with a new term here in Israel, Mo'adim L'Shigra.
I like that.
Okay, instead of Mo'adim L'Simcha, which means happy holidays, it's Mo'adim L'Shigra, return to the...
Shigra is the consistent order. There's a word for that.
Yeah.
Routine life.
Okay, I'm a big fan of also Parshat Noach. I really am. It's just a parsha that is wild, and there's just
drama.
There's drama. It's also, you can hearken back. If anybody has studied like biblical criticism, there's a tremendous relationship between Parshat Noach and the Gilgamesh story and other flood stories.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be a collective human experience.
Right, and I like that.
Yeah, I love it.
No, but people like get freaked out about it.
Oh,
they're like
the things that freak people out.
You know what? But you know what I'm talking about.
Exactly what you're
they're
talking
like,
about.
They're like, it's a copy.
You
it's
can't
this and that.
Say that.
And I'm like, no. You see, that's what it is. It's either a refinement or clarification. However you want to understand it, it's our narrative of that narrative.
I mean, let's pause on that. It's very important as a frame. Is that as is consistent throughout the Torah? What's critical here is not the event; it's the message. Right, and the idea of the Gilgamesh saga of this world in which the gods just willy nilly, you know, destroy the world, and which is sort of like very consistent with sort of a Near Eastern theology, except for the Egyptians, interestingly enough. This idea that the gods, their caprice, like, you know, this flood comes in, that's the exact opposite of the Torah story. Torah's telling you there's a moral will.
Right.
Which drives the universe, which finds its expression on every level, including nature.
Right.
That's what matters.
And it's because of a failure to keep borders on a moral level.
Yes.
So too comes a physical response of destruction, which is one-to-one. You remove your natural borders, I'll remove the water's natural borders. And we learn the opposite of that is Joseph. Joseph, who overcame his natural inclinations with Mrs. Potiphar. Speaking of Mr. Cheshvan, there's Mrs. Potiphar, right? Later on in the Joseph story, when according to the Midrash, when the bones of Joseph come up to the Red Sea, they will split because they will split and they will act unnaturally in a positive sense from he who overcame his nature.
Right, and the central message, I want to be clear, is that there's only one will.
Right.
And the same will that makes what goes up come down is the will that told you to keep the commandments is the will that you run up against in all these narratives that actually causes the water to split in an unnatural fashion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true. It's unnatural because we experience the natural world, the laws that God made. But in the bottom line, the message of the story of Noah is there's only one will in creation. It's the same will. And it's one of the great challenges of those of us who grew up in a Western secular culture, especially comes to light through the story of Noah, is to realize that that's the unity that Am Yisrael teaches. We're not philosophers in the unity of being, and we're not even sort of like biologists in the unity of existence. No, it's the unity of will. Mm-hmm. There's only one will.
Okay, so here's an interesting thought.
I can see by the smirk on your face you're going somewhere.
If it's a religious message in the Torah portion of Noah, it is interesting that we first get introduced to Noah as a person who brings yinachamenu. He will bring solace,
comfort, solace,
comfort.
Sure.
Okay. Rashi says that the way that he brought comfort was in Edisonian fashion.
Wait, no, please. John Deere.
John Deere fashion, fine. Or
you know who John Deere was. He invented the self-cleaning plow.
Is that that's not the cotton gin or anything
no,
like that?
No, the self-cleaning plow, man. That's exactly what it says that Noach did. That's what Rashi says. That he invented the tools that allowed them to overcome the curse of the ground.
Okay. So I was recently listening to a podcast about these road trips that Henry Ford and Thomas Edison.
Right, you mentioned in the last
took it together.
Show.
It was, you know.
Can you imagine me on the road with those two?
Yes. You know what I mean? I could. By the way, they
you would be a lot more fun than I would. I think,
they had a naturalist. They had a cranky naturalist with them. I forgot his name.
I could be that guy.
He was a famous cranky naturalist.
If I get to be cranky, I'll be
on
the road trip.
And everywhere they went, he was a big expert and explained to them about nature. It was interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting thing. They went out to show the power of the car. Mm-hmm. They went out to see the beauty of nature, which they couldn't reach beforehand.
Yes.
It's an irony.
I mean, it's also a deeply American experience that I've had in so many fantastic places that the love of nature and the car in the American experience are bound up
one with the other. Okay. But do you see that those things are in tension? The car,
yes,
and the road is the thing that
is destroying
nature,
the thing
right?
you're seeking.
Yeah, here comes Noah. So first thing is to me is a fantastical thing is that one of the ways that he brings what was the word for solace you used?
Comfort.
Is not through and believe in the one God and his will, but rather here's a thing, a technology.
Yeah.
Here's a technology, and the technology is the thing that undermined the curse that previously reigned in the land.
Yes.
Okay, that's an amazing thing.
Which nominally was at least reminding people that it was their behavior which drove the response of the natural world.
No, but it's not. You would think the opposite.
No, the curse reminded them. Meaning, he's undermining it. That's my point.
Right.
He's undermining the system that should have been in place to remind people to stay in line.
To be moral.
To be moral, because look what happened when your ancestor ate from the tree.
And his answer is technological.
Yes.
And that technology is this like great release from a curse.
And by the way, the solution to the flood, even though God, of course, instructs him, but is also a technological
solution. That's right. That's right. And maybe I'll preview a thought that I have, which is one of the great questions of literal reading of the Ark story is that how do you fit all these animals and all the food in there? And it's practically, on a simple level, it's hard to understand how it's done.
Yeah, because the rest of the story is so easy to understand.
Right. Okay. But it presents itself
very simply
as
a story and then avoids that one glaring question, which is how on earth did he fit all the animals in there?
Right. Okay.
Plus, what to feed them for.
Now, according to the Hasidic idea is he turned them into thought. Okay. As in the blueprint of.
Yes. This is the source code floating
as
a chip on the water.
Right.
But like a
chip in the water.
A microchip.
A seed.
Yeah, seed.
A seed is a DNA chip.
Changing your metaphor. You can't have it both ways.
No, but they are the same, which is it's an informational small thing, which
for sure.
It contains. Now, to me, therefore, another way to say that in a more modern way of saying it is that he was an amazing IVF scientist. He was able to take sperm, egg, whatever it is, and condense that future animal into a test tube. Right. And the whole thing, can you imagine this? Can you imagine that the ark is filled with these little test tubes? It's a
It would have been easy to feed them.
That's right. Well, actually, that's one of the problems with this theory, because it does say that that there's food for them, but maybe that means...
growth medium.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And, like, I imagine the whole arc as this little test tube place, or another way, a seed.
Yes.
A DNA-containing piece of knowledge floating. So he's a scientist. But on the other hand, what is God saying after he reveals to Noah the science and the technology? He says, I'm wiping the whole thing out. It's kind of, what's the word when things don't follow other things? And
it's a non sequitur.
Non sequitur. There's a non sequitur. First is there's a moral problem solved by technology, and then there is a moral problem which is not solved by that technology and is basically wiped the hard drive
clean. Seems to reverse the entire process. And so in pointing that out, which was well done, I think that you are indicating one of the most important tools we use in a deep learning of Torah. Which is when you find discontinuity.
That was the word.
Right? This sense that, wait, it seemed like the whole point of the story was going this way and then it broke that way. Right? There's always an invitation to depth. Right? Because, you know, the Torah has a challenge, which is that it's trying to communicate the depth of existence to, first of all, the human consciousness. And second of all, to the human consciousness across all time.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout life. Meaning when you read the Noah story, when I read the Noah story to my five-year-old, he just wants to look at the pictures of the animals.
Right.
When I read it to my 10-year-old, he's cool, flood. So my 15-year-old is always saying, wait a minute, Abba.
Is this a children's story?
Is this just a children's story? So the beauty of what you're identifying is that the depth of the story actually comes in the invitation that was offered to Noah, which he did not take. Okay, when God says to him, or he becomes the guy who's able to solve the technical problem. And then God seems to reinforce that by saying, well, there's a flood coming. But you got the technical know-how. You can fix the problem. What happens at the end? Where does Noah end up at the end of the story?
Drunk as a skunk?
Face down in the mud.
Right.
Right? And so it's a very strange ending to the heroic Noah. Ish tzaddik haya b'dor tav. He was righteous in his generation. Even if you take it in another generation, it wouldn't be nothing special. And it's an argument, fine. But no matter how he slays it, he was righteous in his generation. How does he end up drunk face down in the mud at the end of the story? And I think that the answer is exactly to where you put, which is that God was trying to teach him something fundamental, which is that technology is a tool in the hands of man and an important one. But will is what differentiates humanity from the rest of creation.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we align our will with God's will, we have a capacity to transform the world that technology pales in comparison to it. Because think about it. God says to Noah, I'm going to bring a flood. I'm going to destroy all of creation. There's an opportunity there. What could Noah have done?
He could have said, God, you know, help us repent.
Or at least, why? Like, what's going on? Right. No, God says, I'm going to bring a flood. Build an ark. Noah says, good. How big?
Right.
Right. As opposed to who? What other character who is immediately juxtaposed with him?
Moses.
No, Avraham.
Right. I heard we discussed this last year. We did this exactly last
year. Did we?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Avraham is juxtaposed.
The parallel story is when God says to Avraham, I'm going to destroy Sodom. Sodom.
Right.
Right. Avraham stands up and says, wait a minute.
Right. That ain't right.
That's not right. And even though in the end, notice.
That's what happened.
It's what happened.
Right.
Avraham is able to absorb and accept it.
Right.
Because he's sought out the question of justice that lies mm-hmm. at the heart. Noah steps out of the ark, and I think he has this realization, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to now use my technological know-how. He plants grapes, and it's not a simple.
And he makes liquor.
And he makes, you know, it's not a simple process,
no,
right?
No, not at all.
But what he realizes is that I haven't fixed anything.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't fixed anything. All just happened for naught. Right? And as opposed to Avraham, who understands the primary message of the Torah and really of creation, which is that technology is a beautiful thing, but it's completely amoral.
The reason I mentioned Moses as opposed to Abraham is
because... He's the other ark guy.
And he's the other baby ark guy. By the way, the ark, just important for people to know, the amount of time that the animals and Noah is on the ark is about a year, a solar year.
Sure.
Okay, the 40 days is
during, exactly a solar
year. Exactly a solar year. And so I said about because there's like half day problems
whatever. Just like, was there a year zero?
Right. Okay. So they're on this thing for a year. It's important to know that. That's number one. Number two is that I was comparing Noah to Moses. And that is, I mentioned this in previous years, that is the Kabbalah's, the Zohar's relationship, the juxtaposition between Moses and Noah. And Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, also gets a command or an invitation that the children of Israel will be destroyed and you will be saved.
Yes.
And that's basically what happened with Noah. The world will be destroyed, you'll be saved. And by the way, let's give Noah a little bit of credit as being a Messiah.
He was a savior.
He saved the world.
Yes.
Not only that, but when God was distraught at the state of humanity, the one glimmer of hope, one of the most beautiful verses in the Torah, V'Noah, Noach Matzachen b'nei Hashem, right? Like, I could see the goodness in this guy, but he was willing to let the world be destroyed and him be saved, even though there's a messianic element to that. Moshe Rabbeinu gets the same offer. He says, nothing doing. In fact, erase me.
Yes.
Erase me. And it's the same kind of erasure. Yeah, the word is a little different, right?
Like, it's what God does to the world.
Right. For sure. Erase me. And it's by the way, Mechini is also kind of, it's a watery erasure.
It's like a wipe me out.
Yeah, wipe me out. Just wipe me clean of your book. I don't want any part of it.
So I want to touch on what you said, which is it's very important, the relationship between Noach as the John Deere, which I'm going to keep pushing, and his role as a savior, because there's a critical moral foundation of the Torah in that as well, which is that if you can't speak to people's needs in this world, don't waste your breath on talking about another.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, Noach met people where their need actually was. He brought them comfort because they were suffering. It's true. Perhaps he was part of undermining the sort of like moral system that the curse indicated to people, the behavior. Perhaps at the same time, when you say Noach Matzachin B'nei Hashem, notice that Chen and Noach are an anagram. Right? Because in the end of the day, the Torah's attitude is that the physical world is not something other than the spiritual world. It's not this world and the next in some absolute separation. There's only God's will. So that this world is where the world in which you build the next. And if people are suffering and you can help them in this world, but instead you speak to them about the next, then you have missed the boat.
Mm-hmm. You got to talk to people what they need.
You meet them where they need, and not as some manipulative sense of like, and then I can draw them along to their spiritual needs, and the recognition that this is where it begins.
By the way, just an interesting aside about that is that one of the ways that Chabad has become very successful around the world is that they've also figured out what people need and given to them. For example, I never forgot this, that they figured out that the Israeli backpacker in Thailand needs an address to be able to get stuff, needs a computer at the time, before the phone revolution, needs a place for internet, needs a place for men, needs a hot meal, obviously.
Right.
You give them that, okay? And I guess Lahavdil, the Christian missionaries also figured that out in the past,
sure.
Like hospitals and all these things that they built up.
Yeah.
And also, all these Hezbollah's also figured that out. Be a social network first,
yes,
and then come into the hearts of people. So he wasn't able to do that. The world, although the Midrash, by the way, says that he did try. There's Midrashim that say that he did try, but the world was in a depraved state. By the way, it would be remiss to skip over that the depravity was partially in theft, in violence, but also in misconstrued sexual unions, a kind not mating with its kind,
non-procreative sexuality,
right? And it was according to the Midrash, those animals that were able to stick to their kind that made it on the ark; those that couldn't were wiped out. The rainbow, as used in the homosexual movements and the gay pride movement, it's a funny irony always.
It's a strange thing. We've spoken about it before.
On the one hand, what does it mean? It means they're trying to say, look,
there's all kinds of
it's a spectrum of people, right? Except me as well.
And there's truth to that.
Right. There certainly is a truth.
It's just a fact. The question is, and it's a deeper question, which we can go into now if we want to. We've touched it before, which is that what do I do when my inner experience runs up against what I perceive to be the divine will? That's part of the whole theme of the Noach story. Well, what do I actually do? Right? If my inner experience says do X and my understanding of the divine will says do Y, where do I find myself? And this is actually one of the most pressing questions of our society today, because for the first time perhaps in human history...
I guess it was even more pressing in the days leading up to the flood. Right?
Well, no, but the difference is that...
had they figured out that there was a problem, they could have been spared, meaning to say there was something coming, And they couldn't figure it out. By the way, we have another 40 days, is the famous 40 days that we just read about with Yonah.
Yes.
Which he comes to a place and he's like, your inner experience is running against the will of God. And they're like, okay, we got to flip it.
No, and this is in general this question of, you know, what do I do with that tension?
Right.
But my point about the difference today is that, at least in Western society, we have a culture which is built at this point on the assumption that one's inner identification with their own will is the standard of measure for truth and rightness, along with a perception that I shouldn't harm anyone else outside of myself.
Right.
The Torah says, no, that's not the standard of measure. It's an important standard of measure. I mean, notice, Avraham is a counterpoint, right? God says, I'm going to wipe out Sodom. You would think that the response is, well, that's the divine will, so go for it, God.
Right, it's your ball.
But Avram actually says...
A lot of people knew from last week, it's your world, boss. Yeah. A lot of people knew that one, okay. It was from Shawshank Redemption, and because so many of you knew it, then I guess it was just too easy. But okay, yeah. but I guess that's what Noah says, which is, Avram could have said, which is, it's your world, boss, do what you got to do.
Right, and yet what we see is he actually, from within himself, the Midrash makes a point with Avram that he had no teacher. There was no one who gave him this tradition. He learned it from his kishkes, from his klayot.
Right.
Right.
I like the way Rabbi Eric Levy says he discovered the way to serve God.
Correct.
I like that. I like that phraseology. I like. He really worked at it.
He
to
for
discover
sure
it.
Labored away at falsehood after falsehood after falsehood. But in the end of the day, the moment when he stands up to God at Sodom and says, "Ashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat," right, the judge of all the earth is not going to do justice. Mm-hmm. He has some inner sense of what justice is, which is in conflict with God's express command.
Right.
And forget the fact that it works out in the end. My point is that we see from this that this is also what God wants from us. So I just don't want to present an overly simplistic.
Absolutely.
This overly simplistic picture of that obedience is the sort of the end goal of religiosity. That's not the case.
Right.
At the same time, you have to look at the story of Sodom and the story of the flood together. Because when the stories of the flood tells us, but God says, I put healthy boundaries in the world.
By the way, there's another story that's completely related, and you can find a super linguistic clue. There's a word in the Torah that appears only three times in the Torah, and that
three
is
times.
Hayikum. Hayikum,
uh-huh.
Which is, it's all of creation or all of their stuff.
Yes.
And that is two times here in the flood and once with Datan and Aviram.
Oh,
right.
Datan and Aviram, the
These guys,
story, right.
Everything of theirs got swallowed up in a flood-like swallowing up of their stuff by an earthquake and an opening of the earth, and some kind of thing was created in order to erase them and their whole Hayikum.
Can we just step out for a minute? I just think it's fascinating that today, much of the secular scientific world is ranting about the coming flood. There's something in that. Like, I'm not sure. It's been in my mind all week as I've been learning the
That's
Parsha.
Funny. That's interesting.
Like, Davka today, and they're warning you about it. They're telling you, change your behavior.
Right.
Don't use plastic.
Right.
Don't, you know, which, by the way, I'm with. I'm down with the let's throttle back our economy and stop these reckless consumption and disposable consciousness.
My brother was just in Ukraine. And he says everybody washes their plates.
It's an American thing. Yeah, we had a student here from Serbia. She said she's like one of these big Jewish camps. Like, God bless her, does amazing things with Jews of Eastern Europe. And she said, we don't use disposables.
Right.
With Shabbos dinner for 50 people, we wash the plates afterwards. Right. She's like, what is going on here? She couldn't understand.
Right.
Yeah, it's
I don't think you have to. I don't think you need. And I reject this false politicalization of this thing. I don't think you need to believe in global warming or not believe in global warming to believe that extra trash is not a necessary thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. It depresses me how it's become like this left-right struggle.
It's so silly. It's so silly. And I just don't accept that. And that's when I say – sometimes I tell right-wing people – it's more an American thing because here in Israel it's not like that. I say to them –
But here in Israel, the environmental consciousness is depressingly low in general.
It is weird. I can't explain it. I would have thought Israelis would have been very environmentally conscious.
Yeah. It's a failure of education, by the way. I just want to point out to you that I know from the history of environmentalism in America, it was an educational effort. It took about 30 years, and it worked.
I have to give you a parenthesis. I was watching. Mm-hmm. I went out of my way to be able to watch Israeli news more often.
Mm-hmm.
To create ability to watch Israeli news.
You mean to just like raise your tolerance, like taking small amounts of poison?
No. A technical.
I language and the skill set and the.
No. I just think it's important to watch Israeli news. I just want to know what's going on in the way that it's perceived in the rest of the country. One of the big horrific plagues that we're having right now is a high year in deaths on the road.
Yes, it's terrible.
It's been like 250 people have been killed already on the roads, and some 70 children, whatever it is. So something horrible. It's also well known that in the Arab communities, it's 70% more than the rest of the average. It's high. First thing is that I actually think that the Torah, when it talks about the accident, negligent killing, mm-hmm. and running to the Arei Miklat, I'm yeah. like. The negligent killing is a plague in our country.
Yes.
And it would be fine if the person whose kid was killed would chase you down and you'd have to run. I get it.
It would be very different. Yeah.
I want to write an article about that. I'm like, you read this thing and you think it's meaningless. It's so meaningful today. I think we may have more negligent killing today than ever. Okay? Because we have this ability, this tool, with an accelerator, it happens. But in any case, I was watching the news, and a guy, there's an organization dedicated to, it's called Or Yarok, they're dedicated to stopping. The news lady, the interviewer, was like, well, but is it our culture? And he's like, no, it's a road problem, it's a car problem, it's a this or that. She's like, it's a Russian lady, and she's like, she's an interviewer. She's like, no, I think it's a cultural thing. People drive too close to one another. And he's like, no, we're fixing roads and we were telling people to fix roads and this and that. And she's like, I don't think so. And I was shocked that the guy from the organization dedicated,
couldn't hear it.
He couldn't hear that we have a cultural problem.
We're wound too tight.
Wound too tight. Or maybe our driving culture is not a good culture.
Although I'll tell you, my wife and I did some research on this because we found it both depressing. And it turns out Israel is not particularly high in the statistics of deaths per capita on the road.
I'm sure it's not. You go to other countries.
Which, by the way, I'm not excusing us.
Like, I was going to say, but
it should be zero.
It should. I don't know about zero, but we should definitely be.
Lower it.
I think it would be nice if we were proud of being a country.
Yeah. Where people didn't drive like it was a video game.
Right. Or Rampage. Remember that video game?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Yeah. So this came out of, I didn't know what to do with this observation, that it's Davka, the secular scientific world today, mm-hmm. that's panicking about this flood to come. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's an incredible opportunity, because what they're essentially saying, agree with them or not, is that we need as a society to learn to marshal social will, which will allow us to solve long-term problems at a short-term cost. Meaning, that's the big challenge of all democratic societies. How do I sacrifice my short-term immediate benefit? It is quite convenient if I'm going to have 25 people at my Shabbos table to just make it all in plastic, wrap it up, chuck it. Right? But long-term, I don't really want to be drinking a credit card worth of plastic in my water every month, which you know at this point everybody is consuming. Mm-hmm. And I would rather the seas didn't cover Tel Aviv, and I would rather that my children had trees and clean air, you know. So, but how do you cross that bridge? And the answer is social will. It comes back to this. This is exactly what Noach is about, is that Noach's ability to master the technology wasn't matched by his ability to marshal the social will. Even though you're correct that the Midrash, I think, tries to redeem him to some degree, because he is called a tzaddik, and in all fairness, one guy versus the world, you know, what are you supposed to do? But this is the great adventure of Avraham. Mm-hmm. Avraham, on a technical level, offers nothing new. And on some level, you look at, like, Orthodox Jews of the world, And as a society, I'm not talking about individuals in their time, but as a society, we're a little bit retrograde even. I mean, like, the fact that we shut down, you know, once a week and et cetera. No, but we're not here to solve the technical issues. When I was in grad school studying international development, I realized the technical issues are eminently solvable. It's the social will that we're lacking. Mm-hmm. This is what the Torah is about. It's about marshaling human will in alignment with the divine will in order to bring creation to higher fruition.
You're talking about the flood, September 11th, 2002. I was living in Manhattan, and a day that will live in infamy, certainly, will not.
It was 2001.
2001. I always get confused because we got.
It was right toward the end of the year, I know.
Right. Right, and then there was I always remember vis-a-vis my wife Malka, who it was exactly 2000. I went to law school. I met her the year 2000, and at some point we got engaged, and then anyway, and we left law school 2003. Yes, we got married in 2002. That's right. It was 2001. That's right. So September 11th, 2001, I was living in Manhattan, and this event happened. I don't want to make it sound in any way light. It wasn't an event. It was a horrific, heinous, mass murder crime. But it was also more than that. Meaning to say, sure. It was that, but it was also, there was something like
a turning point for American society.
I'm losing words because there wasn't words for it, but there was something biblical about it. There was something,
planes crashing into buildings, towers falling,
For us at the time, I remember thinking this has something to do with the Tower of Babel. I remember that, and that's the end of this week's Torah portion, Noach, which we're in. By the way, just a quick reminder: we're in the Book of Genesis. Torah portions about Noah and the flood. At the end of it is the story of the Tower of Babel. And you are with us here on the Land of Israel Network, Yishai Fleisher Show, with Rabbi Mike Foyer here joining us today.
Woo-hoo.
At Pardes Institute. So that was another like moment where we were, and I remember thinking the Jews are going to somehow get up and leave New York and go to the Land of Israel. This is like a big moment.
Some of them did.
Some did. By the way, the biggest, if you don't know this in history, the biggest catalyst for American Jewish Aliyah moving to the Land of Israel was the Six-Day War.
Sure.
And it was 1969, 2 years later, that there was a record number of people who made Aliyah.
Yeah, there's what to be said about that. And that's actually where I'm planning to end this year's season of the Jewish story. With 67, but in the aftermath of while flower power and the hippie revolution was happening in America, there was an awakening amongst a lot of American Jews that there's something redemptive that has come into the world at that moment.
And
the two are related in my eyes.
And the greatest single success of American Jewry had something to do with that, which is, I always like to say, American Jewish greatest success was Russian Jewry.
Yes.
Okay, that's the single biggest thing that they were able to achieve, which is to get 1 million Jews out of the Soviet Union free, and thereby, by the way, destroy the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it was definitely linked.
Right. So American Jews helped free Russian Jews. Russian Jews came to the Land of Israel and to also to other places, and that by later on set a chain of events that undermined the Soviet Union. So that I think that and a few other things are the American Jewry's greatest achievement.
Go back to the Tower of Babel for a second.
Yeah, Tower of Babel.
Yeah, because notice it's the same theme. What was happening at the Tower of Babel? They were all one language and sort of one tongue,
right,
and therefore one will. So you're going to say to me, Mike, but haven't you been saying this whole time, that's the whole point? Like, that everyone should have one will and work together, and yet here what happens is God says, ooh, we can't have that, right? So I'm going to have to, like,
scatter them.
Right, and make them of different languages. And I think that the critical piece there is, you know, it's interesting because it goes back to the technology as well. You know, if you look closely at the verses,
they were technological masters, and according to you can't read it in the plain reading of the text, but the Midrash says they wanted to create a thing that would give them fame, that would give them a way to fight God. It was something between a fortress and a battle and a kind of a battleship or a battle station, and the Midrash really sees them as being quite insensitive to the plight of in regular people. They were a little Borgish. Borg.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm driving at. You look at the pasuk, it says, like, let's make some bricks. We're gonna bake them, meaning this is a technological innovation that will allow us to build higher, right? And they solve the technical issue through uniformity. That's the key. Mm-hmm. Because the Midrash on here says
brick making is a type of uniformity.
For sure. And it allows for tremendous control mm-hmm. over the product.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to if you work particularly with undressed stones. So there's a different art form. You know, you look in like in the Northeast in the States, right, you can see beautiful old walls that are built with undressed stone that are still standing after 150 years because the stonemason understood how do you take an individual stone and bring it together with another in a way in which is enduring. That you have to do by relating to each stone as a thing unto itself. As opposed to bricks, who cares? You find a chipped or a bent brick, you know what you do?
Just replace it.
You chuck it.
Yeah.
Right? It's not worth it. Right, and there's the metaphor in here is very strong because the Midrash says, you know, Evan Maso Abonim, Haita Larosh Pina. The stone that the builders refuse shall be the head cornerstone. We said it this morning in Hallel. Mm-hmm. So who's that stone that the builders refused? Avraham. When? At the Tower of Babel. Right? That Avraham is all edges. He doesn't fit the society that they want to build. Right? Because on one hand, the whole purpose of creation is to be able to marshal social will in order to bring God's will to fruition. On the other hand, that doesn't happen through the suppression of the human will. This is the trick. How do you create a society in which the individual is free to be what they are meant to be, and yet they can come together in an association in service of God and not just in service of self? This is the challenge I see in our society today.
Yeah.
We've created a society of freedom, which is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
That people are free to be what they believe they ought to be, and I bless them all so they should succeed.
Right.
But
meaning to say, it's not going to be forced. It's not going to be coerced.
It can't be. Think about it. Communism, the Soviet Union you just mentioned, the Nazis. Every sort of homogenizing attempt to create one world has ended in horror.
And if you look at the Rambam and how he wants a person to get to that consciousness, it's not through fear and it's not through conformity. It's like, I want you to go out there and meditate and look at nature and you'll see that there's a God.
And be filled with love.
Be filled with love. Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And yet, we as the Jews carry a tradition that this is also bound up with law. And the challenge of law is inescapable sometimes. Forget religious law. Even the law about crossing the street or paying your taxes, when you live in a system of law, in a society of law, at some point you will always come against the challenge where the collective will is not the same as the individual will. And the way in which a culture negotiates that tension is either its success or its failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that to be the story of Noah from the beginning through the end. And that's why in the end what we get is Avram, who on one hand is going to be the idol breaker.
Right.
And the other hand is going to be the seed of a whole new society, which, let it be soon, let it be now, will help bring a beautiful order to the world, not by suppressing human nature, but by giving it its sort of right growth medium to flower.
Okay, so here's a perfect metaphor for that. It's in this week's Torah portion, Noah. God says to him, build an ark, and in there you got to have a tzohar.
Yes.
So Rashi says tzohar could be one of two things. Either it's a luminescent, radiating stone, phosphorescent, but if you think about it, probably some kind of energy source where like it's a uranium type thing where it itself
glowing.
Is right. It's hot. It's energetic. It gives you when everything else is dark.
It is a source.
It's a source of energy in itself. Or tzohar means window, which is that you're going to get light from the outside, whatever light's coming in. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, that's exactly the tension between how a human being has to navigate his life. Either he looks out into society, to his teachers, to the podcasts he listens to what's happening in history, and he looks out and he says, okay.
To God, even.
To God. He looks out and he's like, the reason I didn't say to God, because the to God could also be from the other one.
But that's where I was heading.
Right. But
there is a model. And it's
wait, let me just finish.
Okay,
so one is look out. And the other one is listen in. Listen in. You know, and this is like, remember that song, the Beatles song, The Inner Light, you know, which is like an Indian thing. And it's like the farther one travels, the less one really knows. I can, you know, stay in my room and I could go through all these worlds. I mean, it's like I could go inwardly and listen to my soul and listen to my inner yearnings. And they also have what to teach me. They're also a guide star.
Yes. Absolutely.
And there's God in both of those.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that they're different models in their intention, meaning we are the inheritors of a revealed tradition, and that those of us who take the Torah seriously see it in many of its aspects as non-negotiable. At the same time, where that tradition itself cultivates within us the tradition of Abraham, who stood up to God, or Moshe, who stood up to God. Like, how come when God says, get out of my way, I'm going to wipe these people out, Moshe doesn't say, okay, well, that's the divine
will. You're the boss, right?
You're the boss.
Right.
Right? And so we will always live in that tension, and there's no easy solution.
Right.
And there's no easy solution. And
the tension is the solution. I mean, you'd say there's no solution.
I think that part of the problem here also is that the Torah does not assume that the individual is the unit of measure of history. And therefore, the reality is that some individuals will live to see and some will not, right? That it's all about building a society that can hold that tension in a healthy fashion, which is growthful, right? And this is one of the challenges that the secular Western mind has in relating to the Torah. We see the individual as the unit of measure of being, right? The Torah does not.
We live in such a pregnant and an incredibly auspicious time.
Amen.
And yet, manhandling society, shaping it, it's often not in our hands, and you really, when you enter into worlds of people that do know how to manhandle the press, the media, this, that, it's not pretty.
No.
And the politicians. And still,
it doesn't end well.
A lot of people that listened to last week's show were very moved by our early discussion about concentration and about and about the will of.
Yes, actually, more than one person reached out to me.
Yeah. And I myself still feel that way, and I've been very focused on other things right now, and I just like I from time to time touch the media of what they're saying, and I'm just like, this is bull, this is baloney, I don't want to waste my time with you.
Yes,
but it's so important to be able to know how to access those things, because they are the sources of societal shaping and mind control.
Okay. I mean, there's one thing everyone can do, which is that there's two ways to change the stream of a river. Right? You can do the manhandling. We can bring in the Army Corps of Engineers and dig in a new channel and all that, which may or may not be a good idea, looking at the history of American flood control.
Right.
But you can also be a rock in the middle of the river. Remember that your ability to ground yourself in yourself and to be solid in your belief and your actions will cause the river to flow around you perforce.
That is a deep thought, and that is a very important thought. And then again, though, it just does flow around you, though. I mean, you'd say...
But it changes. It changes the stream.
That's interesting.
It's a different scale of action.
Okay, so the world gets wiped out, and there's Noah and the Ark. I like to think of it as like an avocado seed. I just see it as like a floating.
Why the avocado?
Because an avocado seed is this big thing. You know what I mean? You could really feel the seed of the avocado seed. You know,
I'm feeling it right now.
No, you know what I mean. Instead of like an apple seed, which you don't want to go down
little,
there.
Yeah.
You know, like an avocado seed, you're like, and
got
you also,
substance.
And it also has a little bit of a tail. Oftentimes has a little bit of a tail. You know that if you just stick the matchsticks in,
and let it soak in water,
it'll come out. It'll start to live. So you know you hold this thing
You feel the potential.
At the same time, there is no potential. The world is wiped out. These, however you understand these animals inside the ark, they're in some kind of
meta state.
Right. There's some kind of state. They're in some kind of state. For example, our rabbis, our sages say oftentimes that there was no sexual contact.
Sure, Rashi brings it down consistently.
In the ark, one, because the world was being destroyed, but two, just think of it the other way, which is this is not a procreative moment.
Yes.
It's
stasis.
Stasis. That's the word. That was the word. I wanted to tell you something.
What's that?
When I was a kid, I had one of those thin books that they put out sometimes in America. Those, like, you know, I forgot the name of that brand, but they're like these thin little interesting books.
About
different things, about great authors. Like it's a cheap paperback, like, option of the best authors. One of them was Jack London.
Oh, yeah.
Jack London. Jack London's book. And there was a thin. It was five best stories of Jack London. And yesterday, as I was preparing for the show, I was thinking to myself, ooh, that reminds me of a paragraph in Jack London. And with the magic of the internet, I found it.
I found it.
It's from a story called The White Silence.
Mm-hmm.
And he says like this.
It's the one where the guy dies. He's pulling the sled.
Right. Okay.
I remember that story.
The story is not going to be, you know, if you want to read it, Jack London, great stuff. But thinking about this little seed, this little ark floating on top of the world, writes Jack London. The afternoon wore on, and with the awe born of the white silence, right? They're walking, they're trekking across what is it? The North Pole, the South Pole,
but North, Alaskan tundra.
Right. Alaska, Canada, whatever, that whole area. The voiceless travelers bent to their work. Nature has many tricks wherewith she convinces man of his finity. The ceaseless flow of the tides, the fury of the storm, the shock of the earthquake, the long roll of heaven's artillery. But the most tremendous, the most stupefying of all, is the passive phase of the white silence. All movement ceases, the sky clears, the heavens are as brass. The slightest whisper seems sacrilege, and man becomes timid, affrighted at the sound of his own voice. Soul, speck of life, journeying across the ghostly wastes of a dead world. He trembles at his audacity, realizes that his is a maggot's life, nothing more. Strange thoughts arise unsummoned, and the mystery of all things strives for utterance. And the fear of death, of God, of the universe comes over him. The hopes of the resurrection and the life, the yearning for immortality, the vain striving of the imprisoned essence. It is then, if ever, man walks alone with God. Is that right on? Is that just exactly like this moment where Noah is like, he's on top of this white silence. The world is, it's the tops of mountains are covered. There's nothing. It's all sea. It's all castaway.
You know, it's an important image if you compare the description of the destruction of the earth and the flood to the first chapter of Genesis. It's a very important inversion. Because in the first chapter of Genesis, it starts with the waters coming covering the face of the earth. Right, and then progressively order is laid down, the land appears,
and waters push back.
Waters push back underground. In the end, you get this image of man standing like on the land, right? The Kivshuan, man, is meant to conquer it, right? And Noah, the process reverses. All creation gets sort of concentrated down into this little chip of wood floating on the face of the deep, right? And it's a reminder that the reality is human experience holds both. You know, we have this capacity, think of Noah as the great innovator of technology, to rule the earth. It is part of not only human capacity, but one could argue from the Torah's perspective, human destiny.
Right.
If not to rule, at least to till and to tend, meaning we can bring out from the earth that which it has not yet expressed. At the same time, if we don't value that power and put it in accordance with the will that created the earth to begin with, well, there's a deep there which can be unleashed to remind us, no, you're nothing more than a speck on the face of that world.
Right.
Right? And it's important to read those two chapters together.
Oh, well, here's a very modern thing that happened in 1969. Man got to the moon.
Yes.
So on the one hand, this orb that has been circling us, and it's this mystical orb, it's a chunk of rock out there.
Yep.
And we conquered it.
We put our footprints on it.
And we put the flag down on it.
For sure.
On the other hand,
and Israel dented it.
Woo! Israel, we dented it. We left some trash there.
Yes. Oy vey.
But on the other hand, the minute you got to the moon, you're like,
"Oh my!
I'm a tiny little blue planet
of existence."
Right? Yeah. Like now we also have the same moment, the power to see further out into the world, into the galaxies, the universe. You're like,
nothing.
We didn't really conquer the moon. We're actually totally imprisoned on this little area right here. And further out, well, who knows? And we are a tiny speck.
It's the infinite.
Yeah.
Is anybody feeling nervous?
It's just a funny irony. The minute that you get power, you also realize how disempowered you are. Noah is the good guy. He gets saved. On the other hand, as we said, like,
he ends up face down in the mud.
Right, he's very much by himself. Okay, the ark lands finally, and it lands on the Ararat mountain range, which is in Turkey. Now, the folks that really claim Mount Ararat are the Armenians.
Yep.
Why do I say this? I say this every year. I'll say it again. It was a few years ago. I was working at Arut Sheva. Somehow, somebody sent me. Armenia was having a media, they were trying to attract tourists, and they had a whole ad campaign. And the tagline was something like, Armenia, Noah's way, your way.
Okay, I love it.
They have one measly phrase in the whole Bible, and they were like, okay,
we're going to build a tourist industry
out of this thing. Now, the funny thing is about Armenia is that Ararat, which they claim is there as the mountain range, is not even in their possession. You could see it from Armenia.
The Turks are holding it.
Right.
And they're not to be messed with these days.
Right, and that's no one's business but the Turks, you know what I mean?
Oh, God.
So there you go. So I remember that. And the ark lands. Here's a very interesting thing. You have a caged animal. You open up the cage. Oftentimes, it's just going to run out.
Sure.
You have a cage of, pigeons. You open up the cage, they're going to fly out.
They flew the coop.
Right. Here it says, no, there's a word here where it's like, you got to animate these guys.
Right.
Like, just like as you deanimated them, you got to reanimate them.
Yep.
You got to kickstart this thing. And I think that that's a metaphor for the Jewish people back in the land of Israel. Like, bringing us back here, landing the ark after the Holocaust and 2,000 years. That doesn't mean that it's automatically going to be reanimated. You've got to activate that reanimation process.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a student once who pointed out to me, I was teaching a class in Halakha, in Jewish law, and he said he had this realization. He says, wow. He's like, so the halacha really is like we took our whole culture and we packed it up to go out into exile. And we've been carrying it around. Basically, we've been living out of bags and boxes for 2,000 years. And now we're home and like we haven't unpacked yet. I said, it's true, except you have to remember that we actually didn't just land on the shores. We came like screaming on fire through the roof and like landed in the living room.
Right.
But yeah, you're entirely correct that there's this potential that we carry both from the revealed tradition and also from our historical experience and we have not yet begun to unpack it.
Yeah.
I think it's really the task of our generation, having been born into an absolutely, so I don't want to say absolutely secure, but into the secure reality of statehood, right, to really begin to think, okay, well, how do we unpack all this?
Right.
What do we do with it?
Right. And the verse, just we read it together, it is chapter 8, book of Genesis, Perek Chet, Parshat Noach, and it says the writing says Hotze, but we read it Haitze.
Right.
And Rashi points that out. Amor lahem shiitzu. Hotze im einam rotzim latzet. Hotziam ata.
Right.
Like take
them. Let them go out. And if they don't want to go out,
push them out.
You take them out.
What does that? What does that mean? You know what I mean? It's like an animal wants to go out. No. You gotta. The world went to sleep. Oh, and here's what I wanted to write down this morning in my notes. I didn't write down. Let's take a minute to talk about reanimation on a day-to-day basis. One of the hardest reanimations, especially when you get up to our advanced age, okay? One of the hard ones, one of the reanimation processes, and as a parent you know this, is the morning ritual.
Oh, yeah.
Getting the kids, getting yourself out of bed. Oftentimes these days, I'm just like, you want me to go vertical? Because, like, I'm good.
I'm perfectly fine.
I could stay here for many an hour. Maybe the bathroom needs will propel me up. But
right.
Like,
aside from that,
like,
not and, feeling any pull.
I mean, and let's take it to a place a little more serious, which is there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who would love to get up.
Yes,
but they can't. But that morning ritual, getting reawakening, reanimating yes. your life is a tricky thing. I want to ask you a little bit about that. Is there any advice that you have about that, about the morning ritual?
There's a lot to be said. I mean, the truth of the matter is, in the work that I do with Focus, it's always where I begin. Mm-hmm. But I would say this: the simple answer is actually quite profound. And again, it goes back to this link between the story of Noah and the story of creation.
I just want to show everybody what we're talking about here. On the one hand, we're talking about on the first hand, we're talking about Noah, the animals reanimate them. Second layer we talked about is the Jewish people coming back to the land of Israel. And now I've brought it to the simple question is like, how do you animate yourself in the morning out of a stasis
and the answer is
and
the
become
same
productive
for all three.
That day.
By the way, the answer is the same for all three.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, what does our tradition teach us needs to be the first thought you have in the morning?
Modani.
Right. It's called Hakarat Hatov,
mm-hmm.
right? And which we translate as gratitude, which I think is an accurate translation, but it's deep in that, the recognition of good, right? What gets a person out of the bed in the morning is the chosen consciousness that it is good to be alive. And not only is it good to be alive, but there's goodness.
It's a gift to be alive.
Yes, but I use that word good because
it's tov
in terms of that God sees creation as good.
Mm-hmm.
And then Adam is gifted with this ability to see the good which is not yet in creation and bring it from potential to actual, which is a longer discussion about how to read the second chapter of creation. And then Noah is faced with this moment where, okay, we put everything into potential. Are you able to see its good? Everything should just flow out. But if it doesn't flow out, your task, Noah, is to see the good which is not yet. Bring it from potential to actual. Like you're saying, get it out. Same way. We as a people today, how much of our struggle, we've spoken about this
Wait,
so many times.
What are you talking about the morning, though?
So, again, I'm coming to the morning.
Yeah.
So we as a people today in our land, we've talked so many times, right? The problem is we don't see the good that's there. We don't see how big and the potential.
The awesome good.
Yes.
That good, that's not like good like this is good. Like
No. The like, scale of divine good,
right.
Which is unfolding in the same way in the morning. Like before, and I'll tell you what I do. I actually literally picture a wall. Because what happens to so many people? They wake up and all the stuff that they don't want to do and all the bad and the things that come rushing right in there. How often do we fall asleep just to get away from it, right?
Right.
And so what you have to do in the morning is actually, as I'm saying Moda Ani, because I don't usually feel a sense of like emotive gratitude, what I literally do is I picture a wall around me.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff.
A wall, okay.
A wall.
Yes.
It's holding off all that nonsense.
Okay.
And just allows there to be a space of like, you know what? It's good to be alive.
Hmm. So you, that wall holds back.
It holds it back. And, you know, I'll get to it because that stuff, some of it is
very, very medieval of you.
Right. So, but some of it is also very real. There's lots of challenges
sure,
in life.
Sure, sure, sure.
There are many things that you may not want to deal with.
Right.
But you have to create that space first of, wow, the potential. It's not just good to be alive in an abstract. The potential. Think of the potential of this day. Before we get to the actual and whether it's going to play out, that right. needs to be what gets you out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can step up into that, that's one of the beauties of having a very clear morning routine. Right? Before, you know, it breaks my heart when I know that there's lots of people out there that the first thing they do in the morning is they reach for their phone.
Yep.
Right? Hey, why let that in? It's waited for you for however many hours you manage to sleep. It'll wait for another one.
Right.
One more hour. Give it a half hour.
And do what?
And just feel the potential of what the day could be.
I'm very into
yeah.
making sure the kids wash their hands.
Yes,
and Netilat Yadayim.
Hugely makbid on
right. that. Right. Like, go do Netilat Yadayim. You have, and we believe, actually, in Judaism that there's like 1/60th of death.
Yes.
There's like a death element in reanimation.
But that's exactly what I'm getting at. That death element, without getting into whatever the spiritual truth behind that in our sages' teachings is, psychologically, are all those things that want to just tear you apart and all those things that are telling you it wasn't worth getting out of bed. Go back to
go
bed.
Go back to sleep. Right.
Go back to bed.
Sleep,
you
right.
can't make it.
Right.
It's only death out there waiting for
right.
you. Right? No, really. That's what people are.
That's right.
You know?
The deep thought is, yeah, if I get out of this bed.
It's only death out there waiting
right,
for me. They're going
right,
to eat me alive and I can't make enough money right. and I can't. And then is that my health? And is that. And these are real things. I'm not mocking them, but you
right.
have to make that space.
Right.
And that's why I literally picture it as a wall around
that's
me.
That's interesting.
Like, hold on. I will deal with it. But not right now.
That's interesting. Okay.
Let me get out.
I want to turn to our friends and listeners out there. I want you to share with me if you have any wisdoms on your morning ritual. Let's call it reanimation ritual. So send me a hashtag reanimation ritual. You don't even have to spell that right because I don't think I would. But reanimation ritual or morning ritual hashtag. And if you have any bits of wisdom, you know, and it could be mundane. For example, Ari Abramowitz says you have to have 18 what does he say? Sips of water or 18 breaths, and you have to drink, you know, like 2 cups of water when you start your day. Whatever it is, people say a lot of stuff. But if you have a wisdom about the morning ritual, how to get away from the fear of death and wanting to go back into the sleep of death, how to get out there, I'd love to hear it from you. So please write that in either to Yishai at thelandofisrael.com or Rav Mike at thelandofisrael.com. So your morning ritual, I want to hear about that. That's great stuff. And the goodness, the joy, the love, and also the service. At the end of the day, like, a person has got to get up there and be like, I have potential, I could do, the world is beautiful. But there's also an element, which is a Ahava Yira type of attention, which is, you know what, I'm not the boss of me. And I have to, prayer is not just me asking God for something, it's me serving God.
I think actually a posture of service is one of the most important elements of a life of happiness.
Yes.
And it's in service of God, in service of those we love, in service of Am Yisrael, in service of humanity.
Posture of
whatever.
Service. Great phrase.
It is a very important part of the work that I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's finish off. Time is limited, so just one last phrase. God makes a new covenant with Noah and Noach, and he shows him the rainbow. The rainbow, subjectively speaking, but the subjective statement that I'm making here is almost ubiquitous to the point of objectivity. People think that the rainbow is beautiful. People want
it's
to look.
Cool.
People want to look at a rainbow.
Yep.
People are surprised at the rainbow. Little kids will be like when something refracts and they're like, "Look, there's a rainbow."
Right.
There's something about the rainbow. But our sages are not exactly in the same tune. For example, they say during the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, there never appeared a rainbow.
Right.
And they say that in a positive sense.
Right.
And according to some, you're not supposed to point out to others a rainbow.
Right. Even though there's a bracha for seeing
it. And yeah, that's right. You see it. You, right.
There's attention
and,
there.
And other than like really, really special people, most people, when they see a rainbow, you're driving, you're like, look.
Ooh, yeah.
Look at that.
Probably Molly's a meme you may remember from when you lived there. It's like the perfect rainbow town.
It's got a rainbow area.
Yeah,
which
it's like right there because of the rain shadow of the mountains of Jerusalem.
It just happens. It Mamish, happens there. Right?
On a regular basis.
And I'll never forget, I went with Alex Trayman, I was on a Birthright trip. We saw two rainbows, and one was on its side. One was like a, what do you call it? Like a parentheses. It was just on its side. It was marvelous. Something unbelievable. You've seen it.
Yeah.
So what's the deal with the rainbow?
I mean, first
friends,
of all,
enemy,
the frenemy.
Frenemy, right?
Yeah, because part of the power of the rainbow
light is refracted.
Is that it's a reminder of what almost happened. Remember the rainbow? God says, "I'm going to put the rainbow in the clouds just as a pledge that I won't destroy all of the world again."
And I will see the rainbow, and I'll be reminded.
Right,
God says,
"But remember, that means the implication is that I would if I didn't remember."
Right.
Right, so there's a sense of threat that the rainbow holds in the narrative, I would say.
In the narrative, but not in its...
No, but experientially, and this is perhaps also it goes to a deeper level. Remember, the rainbow is one of the only, if not the only, natural phenomenon that it takes human experience for it to exist. I mean, your point of view makes that rainbow exist as much as the sun and the rain. Mm-hmm. It takes the sun, the rain, and where you're standing. Because the sun and the rain falling, I could be uphill and see the rainbow, and you could be downhill and say, look at the rainbow. You're like, well, what are you talking about? I see a rainbow. Right? And so that subjective element is simultaneously the expression of the beauty of what humanity has to add to creation, our own perspective, our own will. At the same time, it's a lot of its problem. You look at the way this story goes. God wants Noah to be like Abraham and bring his subjective perspective in order to bring creation to fruition, to its higher realization. At the same time, we see, but wait, this whole parsha is filled with all these people who are using their subjective perspective to do what they think is right, and it's not working out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's knife edge that we feel in the rainbow, which is that it's a powerful, beautiful symbol, but it's also a reminder of the fact that we always stand on the razor's edge.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take.
That's a very interesting take. Why does it have to be this natural phenomenon of refraction of light?
Because it expresses the fact that there's always more there in creation.
There's perspective, like you said. There's more, and there's also the tension between unity and like the pride movement has a truth in it, like we said.
Absolutely.
Like there's an element of like.
Yeah.
But I always make a joke, which is that they before God strikes them down, they're just like, look.
Oh,
here's the rainbow. You don't want
to. There's truth to that as well, which is like the other way of saying it is like, you made me, God.
Right, right.
I'm not a mistake.
Right. But then again, God is like, but.
Yeah. So I made you and I gave the Torah as well.
Right, that's right. All right, folks. So what do you think about the rainbow? I'd love to hear from you. What's your rainbow experience? If you want to write me a rainbow experience or send a picture or something.
Wait, why are there so many songs about rainbows?
Just there's something about the rainbow. Yeah, like there's that guy that you know.
Well,
that,
you get the reference?
What?
We'll see if anybody got that.
I didn't get the reference.
All right, let it go. I'm not giving it away.
But there's that like that.
Write to Yishai and tell him he needs to get
there's
culture.
There's that Tahitian guy or Hawaiian guy that sings Somewhere Over the Rainbow on the little ukulele.
Yeah.
You know, and his name is Israel or something. You know, somewhere he was obese and he passed away. But whatever, it's like the rainbow is definitely something, and you know, it's a Wizard of Oz thing. It's Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It's there's something about that. So I want to hear from folks out there what they think about the rainbow. Thank you for sharing the rainbow. Actually, we have I give Skittles when I teach Torah to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we always tell them, you know, taste the Torah or, you know.
Oh,
and don't you have a rainbow meal coming
up? Rainbow Shabbos coming up.
You have a rainbow meal every year,
I've already got the menu planned out in my mind.
Like what?
I mean, the salads will be probably some sort of cherry tomato salad. And there will be a carrot salad, a corn salad.
Mango?
Maybe mango's interesting. It's an interesting idea. It'll be sort of pesto and beets. And then the main dish. I mean, I don't go into detail the whole meal.
I love it.
You get the idea.
No, so every year you make a rainbow meal on Parshat Noah.
Yes.
And I usually go to the zoo or some kind of zoo.
Yeah.
And here again, just I know you got to go, so we're finishing up. But like every year I'm telling the state of Israel, you know, hey, imagine if you made like zoos for free on Friday of Parshat Noach and make it into a thing.
Do it, man.
Into a thing. Enjoy the thing. All right, folks, taste a rainbow. More great stuff is on the way. Malka Fleischer is up next. Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much. People can also join you at your website, which is jewishstory.co. Facebook.com/RevMike or just RevMike@thelandofisrael.com. And your other great show here is The Jewish Story, dealing now with beginnings of the State of Israel. And
yeah, we're 1958.
Right, and moving into kind of its Middle Ages. Or, I don't know. It's
adolescence.
That's right. For me, check out YishaiFleischer.com, and we're having a lot of fun on Twitter, fighting with J Street and a lot of other stuff. So there's many, many ways to connect. And have a great first day of the rest of your lives, folks. More great stuff is on the way. Stay tuned for Malka. Rabbi Mike, thanks again.
Always a pleasure. Thank
you. Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom.
You know, it's not just a refinement of the Jews, and it's not just the strength of the Israelis now, but there is a whole world of the nations that are a part of this process, and they are being refined just as well, and they are going against the grain. With the rise of anti-Semitism, it's going to get harder and harder to stand up.
And there's no running away from it either. I mean, there's nothing greater than living as a Jew, especially in our world today, where we see the ingathering of the exiles from all around the world. They're coming back to the land of Israel. We have our own state. The technology, the innovation, the light that's coming out of the Jewish people in Israel is unparalleled. And that's part of what we're trying to broadcast here on the Land of Israel Network and share that message.
Israel Inspired with Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting this part of the show from Judea, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Once again, it is late night. It's 11:30 here in Judea after a very, very long day and bit of a draining day. Thank the Lord.
Thank the Lord. Well, draining. I guess that means you worked hard.
I worked hard. I had only one moment of play in my day today.
You played?
No, it wasn't a play, like a moment of downtime.
Okay.
Really, I had really one moment of downtime in my whole day. And that little moment was this restaurant that I like to go to. I got this restaurant that I go to now on Wednesdays. It's like now I'm...
That's cute, where everybody knows your name.
Nobody knows my name. And nobody knows my name. Nobody cares to know my name there. But it's my kind of restaurant.
Well, not yet. You don't... how many times have you been there in a row?
Twice.
So that doesn't count yet. Once you go for your third time, they call that a chazaka.
Right.
Like, third time's the charm, sort of. And then people will be like, you know, you come in here every week. And then you'll be like those guys down at the bar.
Yeah. The only difference is that I'm not, like, pining away for anybody to know my name. There's something else that happens there altogether. It's not a social thing.
You eat
thing.
A good lunch?
I ate a good lunch, but the kind of restaurant it is what in Israel is referred to as a taxi driver's restaurant.
Well, how is that said in Hebrew?
Nagim. Misadat Nagim.
A driver's restaurant.
A driver's restaurant. Nagim Oniot, or a cab driver's restaurant. And it's exactly the kind of food that I like. It's plain. It's good. It comes out fast. Whatever you ask for, it comes out within like 2-3 minutes. It just comes right out. Mm. They have moussaka there.
It's called bishul sirim. They cook everything in big pots.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
big pots, and they just
it's
plop
a bunch
it
of
on.
A bunch of Moroccans.
It's Moroccans. It's Arabs.
So it's delicious.
And the kind of food it is, like for example, I had today schnitzel with rice
that
and
very
beans.
Moroccan.
That's what I had: schnitzel, rice, and beans.
What kind of beans? White beans. Green beans?
No, not green beans. Like beans.
Little white beans?
No, not little white beans. The kind of beans that you buy in a can, you know, the
like
brown,
little tan?
Yeah. Yeah, little, not very little, medium-sized tan beans.
Like in America, in Israel, we have like a less sweet version of baked beans here.
Yeah.
It's less sugary. More like a stewed beans.
Right, less sugary.
Saltier.
I generally am a big fan of beans in general. I love beans.
They're good for your heart.
Yes, and I do like to eat them. And they're good for me. And they just make me feel proteiny and good. and I had a Diet Coke. And it was just...
Yeah.
And I do believe, by the way, that the rabbis only messed up on one thing, which is that they did not make a blessing for Coke on itself.
You think so?
I think that Coke deserves
what would you
its own
bless
blessing.
It with?
Blessed art thou, Coke, for, you know, blessed are you, King of the Universe, creator of the Coke.
That's it?
Yeah, it's just its own goodness. It's its own.
Or maybe there should be an after bracha.
I don't know, but whatever it is, we all know, and those who know, that
sometimes
Coca-Cola.
A Coke.
Yeah, sometimes
this is not a non-paid for. I wish, halavai. Coca-Cola.
But at the end.
Call us.
At the end. at the end of my meal every time. Oh, and what did I do? I listened to Torah while I was eating. I had my.
What'd you listen about?
The Parsha.
Nice.
Parsha Noach, which is really one of my favorites. And I have a lot of favorites, though, so that's not like saying a lot. But I really love Parsha Noach. I get into it. It's like a movie for me. It's like I get very excited.
Well, there was that movie Noah.
One of the worst.
few movies that we went and saw in the theater. I wouldn't say it's one. There were elements. I mean, some of it was insanely incorrect. And you're just like, why are you making this insane movie?
What's Mr. Gladiator's name again?
Russell Crowe.
Russell Crowe.
Please.
Sorry.
This is like basic human facts, okay?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So Russell was a little nutty in that movie. But
there were some cool parts. But basically the story is not the story as it goes down in the bio. It's like an utter departure from the story.
You weren't there in my last half with Rabbi Mike this week.
I should watch
week.
A little Noah.
Yeah.
Or not.
I wanted to say about that, actually. First thing is, in the last half, I described Noah as actually a great scientist, that is not just the part about the test tubes, but also I showed that actually Noah himself was also, we talked about in the last half, was also the man who brought better farming equipment and helped them overcome the curse of the land that was still around from first man's time. So and Rabbi Mike called him John Deere. I called him an Edison. But like, he was an innovator of stuff, and he brought kind of peace to the world through that. In any case, he was a scientist. But speaking of movies, there is a movie that I'm going to recommend publicly. It does feature a few very minor lewd remarks, and let's just put it this way. On the scale of today's movies, it is very, very, very innocent and innocuous.
And yet it's not for everyone.
It may not be for everybody. I'm giving that warning for those people who especially would consider themselves ultra-Orthodox and listen to this show. But really, for any modern viewer, it is way clean, and it's called Evan Almighty. And I do recommend this movie as a biblical movie. Okay, it's a movie about this guy, Evan, turning into Noah. And building an ark in a modern day, and the adventures of how he like becomes a more biblical character and builds this ark, and in the face of dangers to losing his family and his job as a U.S. congressman. And it's actually a fabulous movie, really well made.
Steve Carell plays Noah.
Steve Carell. There's a guy.
Plays Evan.
Right, plays Evan who becomes New York Noah. And it's just one of my faves.
It's cute.
And it's a good, clean movie. And it's
definitely a week. Isha, did you tell everyone what they should do this week?
Well, we talked about going to the zoo.
You talked about that. You always talk about things with Mike. I'm so jealous.
Well, Mike is earlier
what is
in
that?
The day. If we would record a night before, then you'd be first, okay?
I want to be the one who said the thing about the zoo.
Go ahead, say it.
You guys should go to the zoo. There, I said it. It's lost all of its glitter.
People should go to the zoo, or if you like have a bug in the house, you should celebrate it and just be like, look at this little bug.
Didn't you kill a mosquito today?
I may have killed a mosquito, and I did flush a spider. Okay.
Oh, what?
It was a bad little spider. It was not good. I found it in our silverware.
Oh.
I was looking for
maybe it was like King David's little spider just wanted to make
you
a web.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
King Probably David not. Was it was a bad spider.
Yeah. But life, Malka, goes on. We are a week before Bat Mitzvah, and also the influx of family from outside of the land of Israel. And so it's going to be from here on end, we're entering a slalom period. And
thank the Lord, we have made small events before. Like, I thought that making like a bris, for example, a brit, was kind of making a big event. But this is actually our first like big children's family event. And I feel like I've learned so much.
Au contraire, we also ran another little event called your wedding. Okay, and...
Yeah.
That was in full-on event band.
Yes.
Photographer.
You a little bit took care of all that stuff, though, so I did not really... I've never planned on a big event.
Well, this one is definitely going to have a little more pink and stuff.
Yeah, there's going to be more pink in this one.
In this one. I wasn't like, when we did the last wedding, I wasn't like worried about the colors of the tablecloth. I don't remember a discussion like that even for 1 second or what was going to be.
I think it was white.
Yeah, and I don't remember there being centerpieces.
There must have been something. I can't remember. I guess it was all right. We got married. It was fine.
It was too bad. 2002, Malka. Okay, and we were also together in 2001. I talked about it a little bit in the last half of the show about September 11th, and the reason I remember September 11th is because of this week's Torah portion, which ends with the Tower of Babel, with the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babel,
babbling.
Yeah, the one that went down. God kind of took down that tower, and here also was a tower that went down. And also here, like, people spoke one language, which was the language of the world financial center.
Money.
There was definitely, you know, one language there. And for us, that was also something that around that.
Right. We got together around that period. That right, was so long ago.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of Islamic Jihad terrorism, the Americans got this guy.
Al-Baghdadi, Abu Bakr.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who died like a...
I think Trump is, like, he pulled it off, right? But, like, you could say it, right? It's not that hard. Not that you don't lose huge points with me for that. That's not a big deal. But it is a little bit funny that it's so difficult for him.
Yeah, but you know what? He may have had a hard time pronouncing it, but he didn't have a hard time talking in the Middle East language, which was like, you die like a dog, you die like a coward.
Oh, man.
Our kids
have been
quoting
that. I liked
how
he kept the metaphor going. Like, he talked about puppies and stuff like that.
Yeah, our kids are still talking about
that.
Oh,
yeah, our kids. We didn't watch the whole... Did you watch the whole speech? I didn't watch the whole speech. I watched, like, the little snippet that was on the news.
Yeah.
And it was like, they died like dogs, they died like cowards. And the kids were, we very rarely watch the news with the children, but we happened to be watching it with them that day.
Yep.
And they were like, he died like a dog.
But they didn't even know who
like
this guy
coward.
Was.
They were so like, I mean, not that they used that language, but they were kind of moved, I guess, impressed by that language.
Yeah. And actually everybody in the Middle East was. The only thing is that people don't know is that the death of Baghdadi, which happens to be, by the way, my rapper name, which is Baghdadi, which replaced my other rapper name, which was Transjordan. Okay?
Wait, don't you have one more?
I have other Abu Khumus. I don't know. I got all kinds of names. I don't remember right now. But I definitely remember Transjordan and Baghdadi. That's right, Baghdadi. Not Abu Bakr, just Baghdadi. Those are my rapper names. But... Oh, Malka, you threw me off. Oh, one thing that is a problem that people have to know is that people don't know this. A lot of ISIS were actually people who left, soldiers who left the Iraqi army. And ISIS is really a Sunni, kind of a fanatical Sunni sect. But they were really standing up to the Shiite influx into Iraq and into northeastern Syria.
Wait, ISIS was?
ISIS, which is really a Sunni army that was, for all of the bad stuff that they did, one
like
of the...
Like beheading innocent people.
They're bad folks. Don't get me wrong. I'm
that
I'm
video,
not
a, remember when they were putting out videos?
Yeah, yeah. Those folks were bad. But my point is that just know that Trump may have, you know, been happy that an enemy of America went down, but another group of people that were happy were the Iranian mullahs, who are like, great, thank you very much. Just like they said thank you very, very much to America for getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a very, very bad person.
He deserved to go.
He deserved to go, but...
But he was a buffer.
He was a buffer and kept Iraq...
An actual country. Now it's just not. And it's also just like a playing field for all these wars now.
The Iranian Shiite takeover at bay. And now more and more. Now the Americans very stupidly left Iraq to be democratized. That was a silly absurd joke.
Well, they didn't both leave it. They're like, here you go. We've created you this president.
That's what I said.
Why don't you guys just take this guy and he's so great. Look, he's your president.
Yeah.
That didn't work out.
Yeah. And this, by the way, was a little bit of fault of a naive George Bush and his reading of a naive book by one of our own, the former prisoner of Zion, Natan Sharansky, who wrote this book, you know, about democratizing the world and that it could happen and that you could kind of the light of democracy. But the bottom line was the Arabs of Iraq and the various tribes and stuff were not about to accept democracy and turn Iraq into some kind of Western democratic state. And it was just an absurd way to do it. The way it should have been done is divided into four. Make a Kurdish part of the town, a Kurdish part of Iraq, a Sunni, a Shiite part of Iraq, and there's various tribes there that could have been taken over, a Christian part of Iraq, and divided into four basically countries and let them kind of keep the borders. But America did not do that. And the big winner was Iran, who is marching through all of Iraq, now encircling the Arabian Peninsula, with their takeover of Yemen and of course, loving the relationship that they have with Assad in Syria. And now the corridor is just open. Okay. And the corridor was actually a little bit stopped by ISIS fighters. So, you know, there's the enemy of my enemy,
delicate
right?
Delicate ecosystem out here.
Yeah. Delicate ecosystem or, indelicate ecosystem. From my point of view, they should all be flooded out. And I'm talking about the jihadis and the murderers and this kind of fanatical way of thinking. But the bottom line is we have to contend today with two old empires that want to come back. One is the Ottoman Empire that wants to come back,
right?
in the form of Erdogan, who is really an old Ottoman empirical type of character, and Iran, a much more ancient
Persian Empire
that wants to seek to take over, and the Arab empires are in a sense shrinking right now.
Why do you think they want that though? Why can't they just be happy with what they have?
I want a bigger Israel. I want Israel to be
big
and strong.
Yeah, but you don't like, you're not like, ooh, like even if you got bigger Israel, like let's say we got that scenario in which we got the greater Israel. Would you then be like, let's take Egypt too? You wouldn't do that.
Okay, because my boundaries are boundaries bound by an idea that's not mine, which is God's. But if you're your own boss, and if your ideology is the more Shiite Islam controls the world, the better it is, the truer it is, and then the Mahdi is going to come back, the hidden seventh
like the
Messiah,
Islam,
right?
Yeah.
So you want to control the whole world. We don't have that problem. We don't have that that desire. So I've always felt a little bit of conflict in my heart about the destruction of Saddam Hussein. On the one hand, if you read about him, he was just a disgusting, horrific human being.
Absolutely.
Just
as were his
just
sons.
Evil, really, like an evil person. And so when he was hanged, I was happy that an evil force was. But at the same time, if you left a vacuum, it created a political military situation, and it's how you do it. You know, you can't leave a vacuum like that. You can't leave a vacuum in the Middle East.
Yeah, but it's been miraculous in some ways, Ishai, especially for Israel, because it's changed the way that Saudi Arabia looks at Israel, for example.
That is true. You speak the truth.
Which also opens the door to other Arab relationships with Israel. So it like has changed. It's changed the whole dynamic. But not only in bad ways.
Mm, very interesting. Very interesting. Yes, Malka. So you went dress shopping and you only cried, what, a few times?
I only cried like two times.
That's great. Okay.
Which is great.
And we had the DJ lady here today talking about...
Yeah, we talked about all the music that we're going to play.
And magnets and things in
magnets.
That.
Magnets. Oh, man. I know so much more now. My sister-in-law, who's so awesome, offered to go with me to find a dress for myself. The thing is a week away, this party, and I was like the last person left without what to wear. So she offered to go with me, and we went to Jerusalem, and I, like, for a second, her oldest child, He Should Live and Be Well is 6 years old. I was almost like, here is all the information you need to know about making an event in our beautiful country, Israel, and all the things I didn't know. And then we've already explained to our daughter more than once in her life that, like, with the first child, you screw them up and you're it. So the end, like, good luck with that.
It was pretty funny when I called you during your day out looking for
Why do you keep wanting to talk about this?
I just thought it was funny just to see, I picture my beloved wife in a dressing room.
What is wrong with you?
And choking.
Why are you airing my dirty
that?
Laundry in front of all these nice people?
No, because we all.
And why is that funny?
You know what?
Laugh at you when you're in your moment of standing in the dressing room feeling like nothing looks nice on you and you can't find a good dress.
You know what? I lost a screwdriver.
Yeah.
And I'm quite upset about it. It's my father's.
That's hilarious. See, that's not funny at all.
It's my dead father's screwdriver.
That's really. The truth is, I looked for it and I'm really sorry.
Yeah. So if you don't mind,
but
folks.
But why are you just bringing in that little sympathy moment?
Funny.
So that we could talk about how you thought it was funny that I was.
I think you missed the point. The word when I said funny, I wasn't trying to say it was funny, ha ha ha, like that incredibly loud ha 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 that you just did. I didn't do any incredibly loud ha ha. I meant funny like, oh, there's a word in English. Oh, how, you know, we are people of emotions and how yes. That's what I meant by funny. I didn't mean like funny like Mel Brooks funny. I meant like funny like.
Because you were laughing when I spoke
to
you on the phone.
No, that wasn't a laughter of like funny. That was a laughter of sympathy and of like sometimes laughter can replace crying. I don't know if to laugh or cry. You know what I mean? That kind of thing.
So you were crying along with me? That was a sympathy laugh?
Yeah. It was a lighthearted like I understand the situation that you're in and I feel you. I feel you. I'm with you. I get you. And at the same time, I'm also here to comfort you, to remind you that it's going to be okay. And after I got off the phone, I prayed to the living God.
Wow.
Amongst other great things, for example, to keep Israel
for the Messiah to come.
For being attacked by
the
nuclear
third temple.
Iran or something like that. Yeah. And, you know.
And me and, to have a dress for
right,
the Bat Mitzvah.
Right. You know, that we should find the famous stone cutting worm, you know, the shamir and all
so
that kind
cute.
Of stuff like
I
that.
I want to see that worm.
On all of those things, then I also said, "And Lord, along the way,
yes,
if thou
do have a dress,
if thou doesn't mind,
thou dost you, not, dost can, not mind.
Can you help out my beloved wife who happens to be sobbing
in a dressing room,
in a dressing room somewhere in Jerusalem? That's all. See,
you shouldn't talk about these things.
We don't have
that kind of a lifestyle radio show where we talk about every single thing.
All I'm saying is, my friends, here's let's get it back to a moral lesson.
Okay,
which is every day we have our struggles, and let's pray for one another to overcome those struggles. At the same time, let's also try to keep perspective and remember where other people are, including people who are listening to the show right now. And this year, I'm still saying kaddish for a friend of mine who took his life because he really saw only the darkness. And so this year, I'm especially sensitive to moments that break us and make us feel really, really small and mm-hmm. broken. And I'm concerned about that this year.
Wow.
I really am. I'm not. This is not a joke.
Sure.
I am truly like more sensitive,
sensitive to
well, to this thing.
Meaningful.
And so when you were upset about that, I, on the other one hand, wanted to commiserate and at the same time to comfort you and to also tell you at the same, a third way, which is
it's not keep that
it,
big of a
yeah,
deal.
Keep
this
it in perspective.
No Holocaust.
Right. And then I spoke to your sister-in-law who was with you and she's like, yeah, it's tough. And I'm like, yeah, basically it's no Holocaust. And it's important to say that it's a little running quote unquote joke that you and I say
right.
It's not a joke,
it's not
but
the
it's
Holocaust.
A, we say it's not the Holocaust, which is a way of saying
like this,
keep it,
this
keep
too
it in
shall
perspective.
Pass.
That's
it
right.
is okay.
Right. And you know what? That lost screwdriver, I know in my heart it'll either come back to me or there's a good reason why I'm supposed to lose that screwdriver so that I'll go to the store and meet the great person or blah, 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 blah,
right,
blah.
Sure.
Or maybe that screwdriver was faulty in some way or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it's important to keep perspective and it's important to keep hope. And I guess when you're 365 days on an ark and the world is destroyed below you and you're a lone speck, what I like to call the avocado seed on the floating on top of the earth.
Mm.
That's the way I picture it. I picture it as a floating avocado seed.
That's interesting.
That's how I see it. Like a floating avocado seed on top of the world. It's easy to get distraught. It's easy to get distraught. And it's easy to feel like you're forgotten. And by the way, and that is what how really the Torah portion comes to a head when God remembers Noah. He remembers us. He remembers us. And he remembers our good things, and he also remembers the world's bad things, and he remembers the covenant that he said he won't destroy it anymore. God remembers. Right. He remembers us.
You know, this year as we were starting the Torah again and reading in Parshat Bereshit about Adam and Eve, and we started to go through the what's the word I'm looking for? We go through the ancestry, like the chronology of the people. Every time when I get to that, and especially this year for some reason, maybe because we're having this bat mitzvah and it makes you think about family and generations and everything, it's like you have to remember that these stories, they are stories that happen to like our grandparents. I think sometimes it's easy to look at these biblical figures as like these legends of stories of people, you know, special people who are detached from us, but actually it's our ancestors, like our genetics.
Yeah.
These are the people that this is, and this is something that I decided kind of, I think while I was hearing the Parsha, but I can't remember, sometime during this holiday season, that I was like, I want to tell the kids more when we read from the Torah, like this is what you come from. Like you're made up of this. Like you come from this.
Right.
You like really come from these people who we're learning about and who we like look up to so much.
Right. This is who we are.
Like it's not like who we are as even like as an like it is who we are as a nation, obviously. But it's like who we are as an individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like your genetics come from this guy, Noah.
Right. We're all individuals.
I'm not. Except me.
No, yeah. I'm not.
That's
like a double irony, but right. You know? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And we're going to get to that, of course, when we start meeting the ultimate individual. The ultimate individual.
Abraham.
He's really the ultimate individual. Really. I guess that'll be the name of next week's show.
Ooh.
I'm struggling to think about a name for this week's show. I'm like,
the floating avocado seed.
Is that, can I use the name of that?
I think it sounds cute.
Yeah, you think it sounds cute?
# floating avocado seed.
Right. No, really? Can I call it floating avocado seed?
Maybe you call it like Noah, the floating avocado seed.
Oh.
Well, people have to know what they're getting into a little bit.
Right.
All right. We'll think about it.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Maka Fleisher, thank you so much for joining
me
here on the Land of Israel
Yishai,
Network.
Next week, are we doing a show?
Yeah. You know, it's like on the one hand, we can't not do a show because it's Parshat Lech Lecha, you know, and it's like...
Maybe we'll have to do it ahead of time.
Yeah. It's Parshat Lech Lecha.
We've got a party to get to next week.
It's also, that's right. We got our own party. And we also got the 6th of Cheshvan is when we left America. The 7th is when we came Aliyah.
Our Aliyah anniversary.
Aliyah anniversary next
week.
Wait,
what year is it? 2003? 16 years.
Can you believe it?
Whoa.
That's
we're
awesome.
Like already like big teenagers in Israel.
Hashem, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I you know, I was walking around Yerushalayim today. Just what a nachas I get just to walk around that city. It's just, I get like, I don't need anything. I could just have like I have to walk from one place to another and it's walking distance.
Jerusalem is definitely beautifying like at a very fast clip. It's becoming like a really, I mean, it was always a beautiful city. Yeah.
I wasn't talking about the beauty of it.
What were you talking about?
Just love to walk it. I just love to walk in it. It's beautiful or not. I don't know. It's just, I just love the people and I love the place. And I feel like I'm home, you know, when I walk its streets and it just gives me a feeling of just calm satisfaction. Like I don't need much more. You know what I mean? I could just walk its streets and eat at a restaurant if I can and you know, go do some work. And I'm just very happy there. That's all there is to it. It's just, I especially like the whole Talpiot area these days. I've started to really get to enjoy it. The whole, whatever, Baca and Talpiot Derech Beit Lechem, Derech Hebron, and all those streets and what Pardes is. It's just great stuff. And of course, Chumus Talpiot, which is that restaurant I was telling you
about.
So I hope you folks meet me. Come out, meet me. Next time you come to the Land of Israel, come out to Chumus Talpiot. We'll have some schnitzel together. All right, folks. God bless you wherever you are. Send us.
Did
any
you just
kind
salivate
of,
right now? Is that what just happened?
I thought for a second.
Like you said schnitzel, and all of a sudden you're like.
I had pictured it. I pictured it. It
is it one of those massive, huge schnitzels?
It's a large schnitzel and thin. You know,
ooh,
really, really. Oh,
yeah. So it's crispy up in there?
Yeah.
Nice.
It's good. It's really good.
Do you get the beans every time?
I like the beans. They're good
for your
me.
Heart.
Yep, that's exactly mm-hmm. right. All right, folks. You're listening to the Ishai Fleischer Show. I want to thank you so much. Please visit one of our main sponsors, which is the Jewish Community of Hebron, defended and supported by the Hebron Fund, found at hebronfund.org. We will bring you in to Hebron to see the tombs of the mothers and fathers and much more if you go to our website, hebronfund.org, and sign up for one of our weekly English tours. Check out our good friends at Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T, for amazing blue string made from the cracked shell of a
beautiful
of
a, little snail.
Beautiful little snail, the murex, and really live the time of redemption. And, of course, check out the rest of the great shows here on thelandofisrael.com. Special shout-out to Ari Abramowitz, who is the man and who listens to every show, who has a great show himself and is a great broadcaster and presenter and a great friend. Special shout out to
Land of Israel Network.
That's right. And one of the founders of the Land of Israel Network. And special shout out to our beloved wives and friends and people that we care about. Maka, I was not laughing at you.
Yes.
I was giving you a supporting.
A supporting chuckle.
Supporting, like, lighthearted.
like in when you do have Della and you're talking about, like, not being afraid and.
Oh,
that,
party
that the week is going to be okay
right.
and everything.
You go, you look at you, you see your reflection, you go, that's right, exactly.
Yeah.
Something like that. Let's have a chuckle out there, friends. God bless you wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Thanks also to Moshe Herman, Ben Bresky, and Tabitha for getting this show out there to the world. And you are a part of it wherever you are. God is broadcasting. All we have to do is tune in. And lots of love from Jerusalem, Judea, and the land of Israel. Shalom.
Shalom.
You want to improve relations between Israel and American Jews, one of the things that you should do is encourage people to listen to the Land of Israel Network. Listen to Eve Harrow, and listen to Yishai Fleischer, and listen to Ari and Jeremy, and Shlomo Katz, and listen to Mike Foyer, and listen to Josh Haston, because the Land of Israel Network has a mission, and that's to spread love between Israel and American Jews. There's so much to love about Israel. There's so much to love about Israelis. And I think the Land of Israel Network is part of the solution. You are all part of the solution.
You're listening to the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting the truth and beauty of Israel to the world.